meeting of this faculty senate, but the first of the 2012-2013 academic year. The first order of business today is to review the minutes of that last meeting held on October 18th, 2012. Are there any corrections or additions?
April 18th.
October.
October.
it was held last, next one. Okay. April 18th, 2012. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, they stand approved as distributed. You received an agenda through email. As a point of information, it is our custom to allow the president to speak when he arrives to maximize the use of his time, and we will change the order of business as necessary for him. With that exception, are there any additional items to be added to the agenda? Hearing none, they stand approved as distributed. Before we go any further, I'd like to introduce our parliamentarian, Marilyn Young, from the College of Communication, late of the College of Communication, retired. Thank you for being here. And she's a former faculty senate president, so she just likes coming to these things. Hard to believe, I know. It is our tradition for the incoming president to share some remarks about the issues before the senate as the new academic year begins. And I'd like to thank you for the confidence that you placed in me by electing me to serve a second term as your faculty senate president. It's been my pleasure to represent the faculty and our interests throughout the past year, and I'm honored that you asked me to continue in this position, a role that has allowed me to better understand the many complex challenges facing a research-intensive university of this size, and to appreciate the solution to these problems lies in the many outstanding members of our faculty and administration who are committed to the continual growth of Florida State University as a leader among public institutions, both in Florida and across the country. Over the year, I've become increasingly aware of the incredible pressures on the institution from the many diverse groups that believe they should have some influence over what we do, or to direct what we do. From disgruntled football fans to unhappy students, and displeased graduates, I've heard from them all. I've also had the opportunity, however, to work with hundreds of people, alumni, foundation board members, volunteers at the foundation, students, faculty, retirees, staff, who build this university's reputation in countless ways. I wish you could see the pride that these people feel in their university and the unselfish commitments that they make to create a stronger FSU. It's really pretty incredible. Still, it's the pressures on the university that are troubling. Of course, you're familiar with the issues related to the budgets and tuition. In the past, the state and the people who ran the state actually celebrated the value of a university education and recognized the importance of having a well-rounded, well-informed electorate. Based on these beliefs, they were willing to use state funds to support the education of our population's young people. Today, it's become increasingly clear that legislators and policymakers question whether a university education is a wise investment. The cover story in the current edition of Newsweek focused on exactly that question. And the writer's conclusion is that for many students, a university education is not the ticket to success. I think, though, that the real answer to that question is dependent on how you define success. If success is just the development of job skills in a particular area, then perhaps the author is correct. Long-term apprenticeships might be the direction to go. If, however, success is defined in terms of being able to think critically about a wide range of issues, to better understand the world around us, and to appreciate the contributions of art and music, science, economics, psychology, culture, sociology, history, the influence of those subjects and topics on our behavior, then the education we provide at a university becomes much more relevant. Though in the face of such questions and the possible answer to that question of what is the purpose of a university, it becomes all the more important to be able to demonstrate that in fact we are having an impact on our students' thinking and understanding. Demonstrating that outcome to the satisfaction of our policymakers is one of the significant challenges we will face today and in the year to come. The result of the uncertainty expressed by policymakers regarding the value of a university education is that they are no longer willing to fund at the same level as they have in the past. FSU has experienced cuts in recurring dollars totaling $105.8 million over the last 5 years, and an additional $65 million in non-recurring funds just last year. That's a hit that seems almost incredible to imagine. Looking forward, the university is faced with further limitations on our ability to increase tuition. That doesn't look like a likely outcome next year. These limitations have a direct impact on the future of the institution, since without additional funds, it's difficult to compete with other colleges and universities for faculty, to create the infrastructure that supports our research and teaching, and to recruit our finest students. Beyond that, there are other pressures that impact the institution. You will hear in a little while the incredible resources that are being spent on the reaffirmation by the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, or SACS. To continue to operate, the university must be reaffirmed. Because of the increased scrutiny of the cost and benefits of education and the large numbers of people who are defaulting on their student loans, SACS is demanding that increasing levels of detail about the university's operations be provided to them. Every single aspect of what occurs at this university must be documented, reported, reviewed, rethought again. It's a tremendous effort. Now, most of us believe in the importance of self-review as a means to improve program quality. But you will no doubt ask yourself more than once in the next couple of years if reaffirmation is worth the cost, especially when the university is already struggling with limited funding. And the work of reaffirmation will impact each one of you. You will be asked to use a common format for your CVs, to review certificate programs, to get copies of your transcripts, to report outcomes in the IEP at even more detailed levels than you ever have before, and to serve on committees to review and establish policy. In fact, you'll be asked to vote on some of those policies on which your committees have worked over the summer later today. Complying with SACS requirements isn't going to be the most fun we've ever had here. But I repeat, we really don't have an option. We need to be reaffirmed. SACS accreditation is not something we can afford to lose, and we will have to remind ourselves of that reality as we watch those dollars being spent. We will also watch as our dollars are spent to satisfy the demands from the legislature, the Board of Governors, the Governor, the Board of Trustees, your Aunt Millie, anybody else who's out there who wants to know more about our practices, our students, our outcomes. I've always found it interesting in the past year that these requests for more information almost go hand in hand with a complaint about how the administration is growing and how many more people are working in Westcott, as if there's no relationship to the two. The accountability is going to cost us money, and that's money that we won't be able to spend on other programs and activities at the institution. We need to be alert to that. We face a couple of other challenges as well. One is the interest being shown in the state for creating yet another, a 13th university. The virtual university, a totally online institution that will have no buildings and few permanent faculty, and I suspect very few tenured faculty. My guess is that it will look a lot like the Western Governor's use of university, which primarily uses adjunct instructors to provide the instruction that the students get. Faculty governance means little in this kind of institution. And I think we need to watch carefully the consideration of this topic in the legislature this next year and use our voices to help shape the outcome. Finally, and perhaps one of the most significant issues facing us now, is the implementation of the legislation passed last year that mandates changes to the basic studies requirements offered at FSU at other Florida colleges and state universities. Dean Lachlan will provide more information about this new law later in the meeting, but it's clear that this is a direct effort to limit the faculty's control over the curriculum. Some of you may be thinking, well, I only teach graduate students, or I only teach upper division students, and this doesn't really impact you personally. But it seems like we're on the slippery edge here, a slippery slope that we need to be vigilant about, and pay attention to efforts like this one, and the virtual university about which I spoke earlier, to make sure that we aren't giving up too much of our responsibilities to shape a curriculum that's based on the expertise of a group of learned individuals, and not just on a single perspective. Luckily, we have Dean Lachlan in a prominent position on the statewide committee that's working with the state colleges and universities to develop an implementation plan, and that several of our colleagues have accepted additional service assignments to work on other statewide committees that represent the interests of FSU's faculty. In addition, your new Faculty Senate Vice President, Gary Tyson, and I will be meeting in early October with representatives from other SUS institutions, from other SUS Faculty Senates, to discuss the implications of this legislation on faculty governance. So many challenges, but there's lots and lots of good news too. I heard yesterday that 42% of our graduates don't immediately get jobs. Instead, they go on to graduate school. Approximately 92% of our freshmen return as sophomores, a retention rate that is one that is other institutions would love to achieve, or even come close to. 74% of our first-time in college students graduate within 6 years. That's a rate that's higher than the national average. The default rate of our students on their loans is 3.4%, way below the national average. And for the first time in several years, the university is not running at a deficit. When you're out and people ask you what you do and how much time you spend teaching and how much, what is your responsibility at the university, I think it's important to say, or when they start complaining about high costs of going to college, when they start talking about the high default rate on loans, you need to say, that's not true at FSU. We're doing a better job. We have an incredible infrastructure that makes sure that those kinds of problems aren't occurring here. U.S. News and World Report recently ranked us as 42nd among national public institutions and 97th among all institutions. Not bad for a university that has lost $105 million. We are indeed fortunate that we are here at a time at FSU when the leadership of the faculty and the leadership of the administration share common goals and are working together to achieve them. You need to know that President Barron is a powerful voice for faculty. Dr. Stokes, our provost, is a powerful voice for faculty. Sally McCrory, the new Vice President for Faculty Development and Advancement, is a powerful voice for those of us who work here at this university. These are people whose motivations are only to improve the university and to improve the working conditions and status of us, the faculty. They know that when a faculty is strong, the university, they know that when the faculty is strong, students are more engaged and alumni more connected. They know and demonstrate in their actions time and time again that when a faculty of an institution is strong, the university itself is stronger and is more effective at achieving its mission. They are also, however, alert to the political realities we face, so their progress may sometimes seem slow and cautious. But never once, in all of the meetings I've attended, and there are a lot of meetings out there, have I ever gotten the impression that faculty, a strong partnership with faculty, isn't at the top of their agenda, and they see that faculty as being composed mostly, the majority, of tenured and tenure-earning scholars. It's also been my impression that our leaders administrators are committed to the concept of faculty governance, as is your Faculty Senate Steering Committee. Over the past summer, the Steering Committee developed a document that we believe further clarifies the structure and procedures of faculty governance at the university, college, and department levels at FSU. You should have found some at the front desk there and picked one up. In this document, we emphasize that faculty governance at FSU is constructed using a decentralized model in which the Faculty Senate determines and defines policies affecting all units at the university, while enabling each unit to enact additional policies as long as they don't conflict with those that have been established for the university as a whole. We note that this system works best when the university-wide policies are limited only to those that must be applied to all units, leaving the bulk of academic policy to be determined at the college and departmental unit. We believe that adhering to this framework and using it to evaluate proposed changes to bylaws, to new and existing policies, will allow FSU to be more responsive to faculty and student needs, thereby maintaining the opportunity for us to create that small college feel within the atmosphere of a robust research-intensive university. In closing, I'd like to introduce the members of the Faculty Senate Steering Committee, Ike Everstein, Chris Harper, Don Latham, Cliff Madston, James Stanley, there she is, Lee Stepina, that's why I'm coming
right in front of you,
and Mary Tyson here. These are the people to whom you can turn when you have suggestions that you believe will improve the experience of faculty at FSU. And certainly if you have complaints about what's going on, we want to hear them. And I'd really like to thank you for your willingness to serve on the Faculty Senate and as members of Faculty Senate committees this next year. We couldn't do anything without you, and we really, really appreciate your contributions. Thank you so much for listening. So, the next item is the report of the Steering Committee. That's Gary Tyson.
I have even more pages than Sandy, except I can read them and see you in the same time. Since our last Faculty Senate meeting on April 18th, the Faculty Senate Steering Committee has met 10 times, May 15th, 22nd, 29th, June 5th, 12th, 9th, August 20th, a long meeting on August 29th, September 5th, and September 12th. We've also met twice each with Provost Stokes and President Barron. At the meeting with the President on June 13th, the primary topic of discussion was the impact of the veto of Senate Bill 1752, the State University of Academic and Research Excellence and National Prominence Bill, and the reduction of the tuition increase made by the Board of Governors. We also discussed the acquisition of the Civic Center and Dr. Barron's assessment that this would be a good financial move. Dr. Barron repeated the message that two of his top priorities are the hiring of new faculty and faculty retention. The meeting with Provost Stokes focused on the organizational requirements for interdisciplinary programs at FSU, and the elevation of the Dean of Faculty position to the level of Vice President of Faculty Development and Advancement. And we also are delighted to welcome Sally McCrory to serve in this position. We've known Sally for years as the Dean, and we believe she's an excellent choice to serve in this new role. We did note that this will necessitate changes to the FSU Constitution and quite a few other policy documents that refer to the Dean of Faculties. We wish to acknowledge the outstanding performance of Jennifer Buchanan, who served as interim Dean of Faculties and who will now serve as Assistant Vice President for Faculty Development and Advancement. So, thank you. We also extend our welcome to Dr. Gary Ostrander, who will start next month in the role of Vice President for Research, replacing Dr. Kirby Kemper, who has performed an outstanding service in this role for 9 years. This Friday, we will be interviewing the first of three candidates for the Deans of Arts and Sciences. So half of you out there should be interested in that, and even the other half should care about it, because it is the major dean. Kevin Carman is currently a Dean of Science at LSU. There will be an open forum for faculty to meet Dean Carman at 1 p.m. this Friday in room 105 at Turnbull. Nicholas Giordano, who is currently a chair of physics department at Purdue, will be on campus on Monday the 24th. And our current interim dean, Sam Huckaba, will be interviewing on the 25th. The open forums for them will also be at 1 p.m. in room 103 at Turnbull. You should be happy it's 1 p.m. My schedule to meet with them is 6:30 a.m., 6:45 a.m., and 6:45 a.m. So I don't know who did the schedule. They didn't like me. When the steering committee met on May 15th, I was elected to serve as the vice chair of the steering committee. Over the summer, the steering committee discussed issues related to graduate studies, including some policy changes that will be presented later today. We also discussed issues related to distance learning, which you'll also hear about later today, faculty governance, which Sandy has talked about briefly, SACS accreditation, which you'll hear a lot about in the future, and interdisciplinary programs. We have included a statement on faculty governance, the one-page statement that Sandy discussed earlier. Hope you read it. As you know, well-defined procedures for shared governance are necessary for the function of the university, and the structural organization of faculty governance impacts not only the Senate, but also the ways faculty and students deal with their college and departments. And that's why we've pushed for this decentralized model. If you have not been aware of the documentation requirements for accreditation, consider yourself lucky, but know that you will soon know what many of your colleagues and most of the administration knows about the scope of this task being performed. One additional requirement on SACS is going to be for all certificates, and that's going to actually change what we consider to be a certificate in this university. The steering committee spent quite some time discussing the best standards and practices for encouraging the development of interdisciplinary programs. Investment in growing new programs is vital to the health of the university, but this growth must be efficiently managed to ensure the success of these new programs. We believe that having the faculty and administration work together will lead to a period of growth in interdisciplinary research and academic programs that will have a positive impact on the university for years to come. Many of you are familiar with the changes made by the legislature in the liberal studies requirements. FSU is fortunate to have Dean Karen Laughlin to head the committee that's actually determining the new course requirements. Whatever changes are made, these changes are likely to have wide-ranging effects on many of the departments that are offering existing liberal studies courses. The Faculty Senate will need to work with the administration on finding the best solution to meet these new requirements. I penciled in one more thing. The anthropology undergraduate degree program was reinstated by the Board of Trustees earlier this month. That's great. So finally, we would like to correct the record on the voting for the steering committee membership that took place in April. This being Florida, there was a recount of the votes for the final position on the steering committee. We had initially reported that Jane Olin was elected to serve a one-year term on the committee. After counting all the votes, it was determined that Chris Harper had more votes. Therefore, Chris will be serving on the steering committee this term. We would like to commend Jane for her gracious acceptance of this error.
Let's hear for Jane.
This concludes the minutes of the steering committee. Any questions?
Dr. Barron has arrived, so if there's no objection, we will reverse the order of business and allow him to do his presentation next.
Suppose there could have been an objection.
There could have been, that's right.
How are you? Nice to see you again. Okay, well, a little bit of dust has settled, so I thought I would come by and give you a little bit of update. I'm hoping that you're beginning to sense that the propellers are starting to turn again after quite a few years of struggle. We lost $65 million, one-time money. It was tough, we have been busily saving because basically we're setting ourselves up to the point where through a lot of conservative action on every part of every single unit that we would start to say, okay, we can do permanent things with those dollars because we have enough cushion to make sure that we're going to be able to come out of it. Now that was kind of unfortunate, but despite that fact, the university balanced its budget this year for the first time since 2006, 2007. I don't know how you feel about this, but it seems like it was an awful lot of work, and I'm truly ecstatic at the fact that I'm not looking at a recurring deficit. If the legislature leaves us alone, we'll begin to proceed not thinking about what is going to be cut again after so many years, but instead where we might be able to invest. We have worked hard, and Provost and I both, to hold all of our academic programs harmless in all of the recurring cuts and even in the one-time monies. The exception, quite frankly, in the one-time money when the $65 million coming up with the $65 million is that was based on a percentage of our recurring dollars. And we were more frugal than some other universities who had not made all the cuts and are now struggling a little bit. And medicine had a substantial recurring dollar amount, and so they participated in the give back of $65 million. Take that away, and basically the academic programs were held harmless now 2 years in a row. So this is our signal, if not pressure, to the deans that it's time to begin to feel that there's sufficient support at this university, that instead of having somebody be replaced by someone who is temporary or not replacing someone, the time is now to replace those faculty. 4 years in a row, we had a net loss of 50 faculty, tenure-line faculty each year. And basically, you look at who we lost and who we decided we could replace, and we lost 50 per year for a total of more than 200 faculty over the four-year period. Tough story. So it was really encouraging to the provost and I that this year, when the new faculty came aboard and we had the announcements and the welcome, that we had hired this last year 21 more tenure line faculty than we lost. So since 5 years ago, for the first time, we've gone back into the plus column in the rate of hiring. I stood up in front of the Board of Trustees and then to the Board of Governors, and I said, look, I'm going to tell you exactly what we're going to spend our tuition increase on, and then I'm going to come back to you a year later, and I'm going to tell you that's exactly what we spent our tuition increase on. Now, a portion, a significant portion of that tuition increase was utilized to make our budget balance. But I said we would use those funds to hire faculty in the big ideas and putting forth the entrepreneurial university big idea, materials and energy as part of a STEM focus, and successful longevity, which is across the campus, as the three areas of those big ideas that would be new and innovative. And in addition to that, I pointed out that the worst and largest tuition increase you could get is a tuition increase that's because you had to stay a year longer in order to graduate because courses weren't available, because we don't have as many faculty as we used to have. And so I made the commitment that we would look at those places where there were significant declines in faculty but increases in student demand, and that that would be the first cut of new hiring using those tuition dollars. It's not a great deal of money when you come right down to it, but I think it's going to have a significant impact because it's entirely focused on hiring beyond whatever our attrition rate is. I'm actually going to leave the details of that to Provost Stokes, just because This is her shop, and she's been working very hard with the deans to begin that hiring process. And then I intend to go back to the Board of Governors and said, you know, I asked for that tuition increase. This is what you gave me, and this is exactly what I did with the money, just as I said. Okay, a last piece of this is our bargaining is going a bit more slowly than I would like. I'm not going to stand up here and try to create any tussle between the members of the people bargaining, but I want you to understand at least a couple of things. One is we're basically told in no uncertain terms, do not give across the board increase, because we know you're doing that on the backs of your students and families in this tough economic times, and you're going to use those tuition dollars to provide raises. This would be a very tough thing to then turn around and have in the press that we used our tuition increases to promote raises. And you may have noticed that, you know, UF completed their bargaining, and really there is nothing there for the faculty. And of all the other institutions out there, and I'm going to discount one as being an old story and not likely to occur, we basically have two universities out there that are going to do something, but otherwise everybody's going zero raises, zero bonuses. Okay, now at the same time, you know that my commitment and Garnett's commitment is that we've got to have more dollars going into the faculty. This is a reason why we propose taking promotion and going from 9 to 12 for assistant to associate, and 12 to 15 for associate to full. And we're also working very hard to put dollars in there associated with a wide range of merit opportunities, a wide range of performance areas, a wide range of equity areas. So this is our objective, to put as many dollars as we can into the pool for faculty salaries without crossing that line of something that's across the board. Now, we'll see how all this turns out, but I just want you to know that this is our position, partly governed by the political realities. And as you know, it was a very tough vote getting our tuition through the Board of Governors, and next year will be harder. So this is going to be interesting. Okay, the last thing, it was kind of fun to see us go up in the rankings by 4, U.S. News & World Report, breaking into the top 100 for the first time since 1999. We basically had this slow decline, and in the last 3 years, we ticked up and ticked up and ticked up, so that's good. It's equally fascinating to see that our financial resources were ranked 204 last year, while we were ranked 101. This year, we were ranked 97, 42 among publics, but our financial resources rank slipped all the way to 212. Now, that's the way it feels sometimes. At any rate, 212, they only ranked 270 universities. We went up in every single category. In alumni giving percentage, we went up. Just so you know, of all the universities in the state of Florida, Florida State's alumni giving rate as a percentage of our alumni giving is now the highest in the state, which is something nice to be proud of. Our alumni are beginning to step up. This is nice. So, but every single category, GPA, SAT scores, freshman retention rate, graduation rate, you name the metric, it went up. There is only one category for which we went down, and that is faculty resources, which consists of two components, one of which is salaries, and one of which is student-faculty ratios. Now, it's hard to beat those when that one is much more dependent on the state. But here's step one, adding 21 faculty above what we lost. And step two, what Garnett tells you about the number we're going to add next year over again for what we may lose. Association, Equity Association, Performance Association, but doesn't quite go across the board. So this is our highest priority, is to see that number turn around as well. And it's sort of simplistic to take this approach based on rankings, but yet there's a psychology here, which is basically look at all these things going up and look at this one category, which is not total resources for the institution. At any rate, we're dedicated to changing those, and we're dedicated to changing them as fast as we can. We also have to live with a certain amount of political reality. And with that, I'll stop. And if you have a question about this, I just thought this might be a useful bit of update on where we're sitting. I'll take any question on that, but as you know, I'll also take any question on any topic.
Questions for Dr. Barron?
Yes, Jack.
Yes, Dr. Barron. I heard you say that there would not be any consideration of cross-board increases. I did not hear you say that there would be no consideration of merit-based increases.
Yes, I think that the argument, the stronger the argument is that this is basically rewarding those individuals that have excelled, the easier my conversations will be, and that's the key. And remember, we didn't even get our 15% when we almost got a preeminence bill through. We only had one signature left that was to allow us to go above 15%. And there will be more appointments on the Board of Governors. So there will be great scrutiny as to what we spend our funds on. Now, I will say, in all fairness, the argument that I am prepared to make is that this institution is teaching more credit hours with fewer faculty. And there's absolutely no reason why those dollars we shouldn't be returning those dollars back into the faculty. So this is my argument. But the last thing I want to do is walk in the room and get nothing. Because then next year this conversation will be worse. Anything else? Yeah.
Just a question on the status of your negotiation right now with the union. For the people that have been promoted as this group that you're considering, will it be a retroactive position of the university once things are finally hashed out, whether deciding what percents come promotions, wait if you're back to the original contract date or not, because I've heard some different things related to that. So if you can clarify that, it would be helpful.
Okay, so Jack can hopefully forgive me on this point. But there's certain things that I want that he wants to hold back until some other things are settled. And there's certain things that we want to hold back, even though we made this as the proposal, until we get this done. So so it's not something that is, we won't do negotiations out loud, let's put it that way. We're very sensitive to the issue. Yeah. Achieving, universities are achieving, something good should happen to them. It might be a reduction in some regulations, it may be revenue, it may be tuition as revenue, and that is the idea. So a lot of this is the push to make sure that they realize what a bargain and how successful this institution is. And many times, I feel like we make a lot of leeway. There's no doubt we made a lot of leeway with the legislature. We would not have had that preeminence bill get a 36-3 vote in the Senate, very bipartisan, if those arguments weren't being made in a way that people paid attention. The Board of Governors is a bit of a challenge because... Is there press in the room?
They were not going to say it if they are now.
Huh? I'm sure that they would normally identify themselves when asked directly. But look, here's an effort to control tuition as a political topic, okay? One that I'm sure pollsters have told every elected official that it's a sensitive issue. And we watched the Board of Governors have a debate, collect all these metrics, do work plans, all of these things, which show that Florida and Florida State shine among the institutions within this state. And then they did not use any of the metrics when voting on tuition. And you watch them sit there and talk about the degree to which we really have to hold the lines, and then we have to protect the students. And then what we watched was trustees jumped to the other side when their schools were presented. So if I'm a student from University X and it's going to be an 8-8 tie on the first vote, which was the committee recommendation of 15%, and no one switches sides, you keep trying to vote till you find something in the middle. In this particular case, trustee from X, who said we can't put this on the backs of students, said except for X, and therefore they got a 15% tuition increase. It was a bit of an embarrassment, and the Board of Governors in this go-around basically said at the meeting that was an interesting way of learning our way forward, and we're going to have to do something where we're really presented with the metrics and the performance measures, and we're going to have to make decisions based on those performance measures. Now, I'm going to watch to see if they do it. If we can get everybody to pay attention to the performance, this university will be okay. If everybody votes a gut story on the national media on runaway tuition and lazy faculty, then it's going to be tough. But you've got to feel like if you keep at this, you will eventually make leeway. You know, they had, and we're never going to be able to not educate people. Okay, I'll give you an example. They sometimes would say, well, look at how little it costs that university to educate a student, because they had a terrible faculty-student ratio, okay? And yet they look at the dollar cost to graduate, dollar cost per student, and they go, oh my goodness, you're really doing a good job. You're a bargain. Well, we need to convince them that they need to multiply that by the graduation rate, because then the story changes. And so this is a case where you just never stop, and we could get 36-3 vote, and next year we're going to have to do it all over again. And so we're just going to keep pushing it, but we're going to keep pushing it based on look at us compared to everybody else. The average cost of an undergraduate coming here, the average cost for faculty, for tuition and fees was $845 for a student. And people said, you can't put this on the backs of families. And it doesn't matter what economic class that you're in. It's still low because one class is benefiting from Bright Futures, a lot of our students are, and somebody else is benefiting from Pell. And so it's really an enormously cheap, and you can't put this in the backs of students, and then you go, you know, my kid pays his cell phone bill that's bigger than that. And, you know, or you may, a lot of you may know this, but the average cost of daycare in Tallahassee, if you just go to the big ones that are advertised, it's about $8,300 a year. And that's babysitting. So we just have to keep working at this message over and over and over again. That's kind of a long-winded answer, wasn't it? Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, this is, again, the propellers are engaging rather slowly because we have to find the money in order to do this. And we hit that on the benefit side this year, with increasing the amount of money we were paying for health care for the graduate students. But it's on our priority list, and we're just going to keep working in them. The whole idea is each year, what can we chip away from our priority list? And this is one of the reasons why it's on our fundraising target. And, you know, probably some people have had heart failure, but I had this belief that the Civic Center is actually going to start making quite a bit of money. Why not put it into a difficult to raise funding category? So we're gonna do our best to try a lot of different things. So, but it's taken quite a few years to balance the budget. We're crossing over to that threshold of reinvestment. It's on the list. We're gonna take it as we go. Anything else? Do you wish to hear from Garnet about the hiring, or do you want to have that?
Do you want to go next? That's fine.
All right, well, my remarks were going to be pretty short. I did want to make an announcement that all of you already heard, which had to do with Sally McCrory and her hire, and I couldn't be more delighted. She started on July 30th, and she's going to be great to work with. I'm also going to be, I've hired Janet Kistner, she's current chair of psychology. She will be starting as an associate vice president in my office on Friday, September 28th. She will fill the vacancy that I have that Joe Nassari, when Joe Nassari passed. So I'm delighted to be building my team of people that will help serve this institution. You already know I'm doing dean searches. We've got the Arts and Sciences Dean search, which is already mentioned. There are ongoing searches for the Dean for Visual Arts, Theater, and Dance, and Dean of Music, and a later search for Dean of Nursing. So I don't think I can handle any more searches right now in my office. I'm fortunate to have good chairs, but a lot going on. But the big news really has to do with what we've been doing to try to carve out resources to deal with the highest priority, which is there are two, which is there are faculty retention and faculty recruitment, trying to turn to build back the faculty ranks. And I am very happy to tell you that although we're losing 50 people a year, we are launching searches for at least 100 tenured and tenure track faculty to begin in 2013. So this will make a big difference in terms of our numbers. Some of those will be funded through the colleges, but I have found more than $4 million in recurring dollars that I am allocating for faculty recruitment in the colleges. About 25 positions, actually 25, are going directly to the colleges themselves to recruit in areas of highest need, some significant STEM focus, but beyond that as well. More than half the colleges are going to benefit from allocation of those lines. In addition, we are allocating tenured and tenure track lines related to the big ideas. So we are hiring a total of 10 faculty associated, tenured and tenure track faculty associated with those big ideas. We will be launching a search for 8 faculty in the energy and materials area, and we'll be launching a search for 2 faculty associated with successful longevity. So that's 10 tenured and tenure track faculty lines, in addition to the 25 that are being allocated to serve areas of needs within the colleges. So I'm still looking for additional partnerships so that we could put that number even higher than 100. Because at that rate, we'll make a significant dent, but this is something that we want to keep moving forward. And, you know, I listened to what was asked earlier about the graduate stipends, and that is on our radar. But we think trying to figure out ways to retain faculty and recruit faculty are the top priorities, and then we'll begin really focusing on the graduate school and the graduate student stipends as well. So there are a lot of things going on right now in my office, a lot of initiatives that we'll be pursuing as I, you know, have my folks all in place. Probably the most disappointing thing to me is that I bring Sally McCrory in to start working on faculty development, and first thing we do is hit her with a whole lot of SACS-related things. So it's a lot of work to do that, but I think that we're going to see, we're really starting to move in a different direction, and I hope that you start to feel a little more optimistic about the direction that Florida State is heading as a result of our carving out these resources to really begin building back the faculty. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about these initiatives or anything else in the provost office. Anyone? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
From 36 to 30. The second one is that we will be required to offer a set of core courses in each of the 5 areas of general education that will be the same across the state, in the state universities as well as in the Florida college system, the FCS community colleges and state colleges. So every public university in the state will need to offer these core courses. Now, the way this process is set up to work is that all of the universities and state colleges have been asked to submit the names of faculty nominees to serve on faculty committees that will begin meeting, we hope, this fall to start identifying these core courses. We are required by law to have a maximum of 5 core courses in each area, so there could be fewer than 5. And the areas are defined as communication, mathematics, humanities, natural science, and social science, which leaves open some interesting questions. I don't think anybody is thinking that the visual and performing arts are left out of the humanities area. Where history will land is a question that's been discussed quite a bit. I don't know how that's going to play out yet. But But actually, I'm leaving town tomorrow to go to Orlando for a meeting of this statewide steering committee on which I'm serving. I'm actually just one of the 12 members of the steering committee, but I will do my best to advocate for Florida State University as well as for the SUS generally. And at that meeting on Friday, I think the goal of the meeting is to identify these discipline committees for the five areas and then to get those committees working. The other big issue, I guess, in this legislation is that the law says that all of this must be in place by fall of 2014. You might think that soon, but I see the chair of the curriculum committee. I think you're still chair, aren't you, Susan?
Yes, I am.
Going through. And this is what everybody who on the steering committee has said all along, that when this law was put into effect, the proponents of it really didn't think about the impact on, well, maybe they thought about it, but I don't think it was factored into the timeline. Even the common course prerequisites, which some of you live with in your departments, maybe not all of us, but also the fact that obviously we know this is going to make some shifts in enrollment patterns on all of our various campuses, and it's going to make work for you as the Faculty Senate and the Undergraduate Policy Committee to be processing how we implement these core courses, but then what impact this has on our overall liberal studies curriculum. So we are free to do what we want with the 15 hours of general education that they have left us, and we are free to do what we want with the 6 hours that have been removed from liberal studies, but remember that those are, in effect, lower division credit hours. So it's going to be tempting, I think, and I think very possible to put in graduation requirements or to have departments consider what they'd like to do with 6 more hours, but we're going to have to watch that because of the balance between lower and upper division and articulation, what that will mean for transfer students coming in. So it's a kind of an interesting ball of wax, but Provost Stokes sent forward the names of the 5 nominees from Florida State. I think every effort will be made to ensure that all of the state universities are well represented on those discipline committees, but each discipline committee will only have 6 people from the SUS. So not every state university will have a voice, will be there on every committee. The last thing I'll say, and then if you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them. My counterparts around the state this has been on our radar since really the end of the legislative session. So the undergraduate deans have been talking about this quite a lot. I think all of us are believers in our general education curricula and have been involved in the development and the administration of that curriculum. So we are all consulting a lot and trying to come up with a kind of unified voice for the state university system. The 5 SUS members on the steering committee are consist of 3 undergraduate deans, including myself, 1 provost, and 1 associate vice provost. So there's a lot of discussion and communication. I'm in close contact with Provost Stokes about this. So, and I really welcome your thoughts about these issues too. So please don't hesitate to fire me an email if you have a particular concern or question. I'll be glad to do my best to be responsive. And if you have particular suggestions, this is the last thing, I promise. The law also mandates that we establish learning outcomes, sort of higher order, I think it's called, learning outcomes for each of the 5 areas. And so especially any of you who have assessment expertise or particular thoughts you have on how we might define those. We've done this, of course, for a lot of our accreditation work, so I'll take with me some of that information, but if you have any thoughts in that area, that is, I think, we hope the committees will start by talking about the learning outcomes and then look at the best courses to achieve those outcomes, but I'm sure that this is a very political process. We shouldn't be naive about that, and so there'll be a lot of negotiating back and forth about how these courses are selected and how they play out on our various campuses. So that's the story. Are there any questions? Yes, Gary.
What's the representative makeup on the committees of university system versus college system?
It's actually 50-50, which is...
deadlock.
Deadlock, but actually, to me, really good for us, because right. when you think about it, we are grossly outnumbered.
Right.
Well, be careful of my terminology here, but anyway, there are a lot more FCS institutions than there are state universities, more than double. So I think the fact that the decision has been made to have equal representation for the two is good. But yes, it is in effect, absolutely, and that there are even numbers on the committees too. So, although, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But kudos to the FSU faculty who were willing to have their names put forward. Not all of them will be chosen to serve, but surely there will be at least two or three FSU folks plus myself on those committees.
Any other questions? Thank you so much. We have reports from two standing committees. The first is the Distance Learning Committee, and Susan Fiorito, a member of the Distance Learning Committee, will be giving that report.
Good afternoon. Prior to the document that you received with your Faculty Senate agenda and minutes, we had the previous document that we have was one that was published in the year 2000. So this is only the second distance learning document that we've had, as far as I could recall. Since the year 2000, what the Distance Learning Committee has done and discussed are issues such as revisions in the curriculum forms, academic fraud and online testing, the approval of online undergraduate program proposals, distance learning fees, the eSUSI evaluation process and increasing return rates, SACS requirements for distance learning reporting, definitions of what a hybrid or a blended course is, and then the need to trigger faculty to let them know when the renewal process is coming up for the distance learning courses. The 2012 distance learning policy document was developed using existing Dean of Faculties, Faculty Senate, administrative policies in order to consolidate a very widely scattered information in one accessible document. In regard to the new reporting requirements for distance learning courses that we've been hearing that are referenced in the policy, and I'll address those in just a minute, these come from the Board of Governors, SACS, and can be found on the Provost website and the Board of Governors website. The Office of Distance Learning, and we have Stefan Russo here with us to respond to your questions as well, but the ODL staff attorney helped with the interpretation of the statutes and regulations relating to FSU policy that went into developing this document. Some of the new reporting requirements from SACS include compliance of off-campus programs with standards and documentation of how these standards are being achieved. Examples include how do off-campus courses have access to material and library services? Where is the faculty that are teaching these off-campus courses? What kind of space do they have? What student support is available for students who are taking online courses, off-campus courses? We need to document the equivalency of credit hours and labs that are being offered. Alternatively, we need to document what we're offering, where it is being offered, to whom it is being offered, show how we are in compliance actually with our own policies. SACS requires that we show equivalence for different modes of instruction. And as a result of all of these new data requirements, a committee was established this summer to revise all the curriculum forms. And that's the curricular request forms. We have three curriculum forms that we're currently using. That's a curricular request form where we can add a new course or delete a course or change a course. We have a file syllabus form, and then we have the form two, which is our alternate mode of instruction. The committee this summer, and we met many times this summer, to get all of these forms into one document and have it web-based. So all the information that you're going to, that you were reporting on a hand copy that you had passed around and signed, is going to have electronic signatures, is going to be visible to everyone who is working in the stream. The data will be collected automatically, and so we're hoping that over time that this will result in a decrease in workload. At first, this is going to be an increase in workload because we're working with two systems now. We're still working with the old forms this semester, but we're beta testing the new online form by this 2 weeks, Suzanne? In about 2 weeks. What we told the Office of Distance Learning is Melissa and I, after we have our curriculum meetings, we will go to the Office of Distance Learning and we will put in all the information that's on your forms into the new distance learning form, and then we'll call faculty and departments for the additional information that's not currently on our forms but is required by SACS and the BOG. We're going to do this so we'll understand the process of putting this information together, how difficult it is to get, how the system works. So she and I are going to work with this for a while, doing all of this before we send it out for all of you to use it. We'll have videos to test our new online form. I don't have examples now, although Suzanne did download it, but we'd kind of rather wait till possibly Darren could come, who is the developer of this, to demonstrate it to all of you. But we will have plenty of opportunity to learn how to do that. That's just the form. One other thing before we go to the policy. The standards of course review are strictly up to academic departments. And they're submitted through your curriculum committees. Your curriculum committees review them, ultimately approve them, and any policies, of course, you will approve as Faculty Senate. But the curriculum committee does not is not going to use a program that will look at the quality of your program before your course before approving it. That should have been vetted through your department, through your college, and so we're looking mainly, the University Curriculum Committee, at making sure that you have the correct attendance policy. That's for curriculum, not online. That you have the correct documentation for honor code in your syllabus. We're looking at things for to make sure that it's clear to the students how they're being evaluated. That's what the University Curriculum Committee does. You and your departments are responsible for the quality of the courses that you're going to be delivering. And I hope that's... So in the document that you received, we would like to get any questions. There are some changes and additions. This was presented to the Faculty Senate Steering Committee and on September 5th. And it was suggested by the committee this summer and suggested that we change the renewal period for online courses from 5 years to 3 years. This suggestion, which are in a couple places in this document, are because technology does change. Because different people are teaching different classes, and we hope with this new form that we are developing, that it will be very easy to make those changes. You will be triggered every time there is is a renewal, to let you know that you need to go in. If nothing has changed, it will be a very easy review process. If it has changed, if you're using, if you have different objectives, if you're using a different evaluation system, then we'll look at only those things that have changed, and we'll be able to do that easier with the online form. So we're requesting a different time period. The other change, the other comment in here is Quality Matters. Quality Matters is a program that ODL has purchased that will allow faculty who are developing their courses to use these criteria in developing their courses to assure a quality online course. They have excellent people in the Office of Distance Learning who want to help you in developing your course. And Suzanne, I don't know if you want to say anything else about the QM review.
Well, the QM, we have piloted with a number of faculty with whom we're working on course development. It's strictly voluntary. Comes out of the University of Maryland. It's blessed by Sachs and Sloan and Board of Governors and many of the other entities around who look at us for quality and academic integrity. It's a great faculty can use. Just go down a checklist, look at their own course, and see how they score. It's really quite simple. We're going to have it up online for anyone to use face-to-face or distance courses. It's strictly voluntary. We pay for it. It's not that expensive. Because when we partner with departments and buy out time to build online courses, we want to do a systematically review them. The suggestion was made that perhaps this body would want to make it a suggestion to avail oneself to that possibility. Also, our instructional design faculty are available to work with individuals who perhaps have never taught online or want to practice and play with some new technology. Then we will, if invited, come back in and look at the course after the changes, if any, are made. The first five courses that we reviewed scored so highly that we were really delighted. So the other thing it allows us to do is report on how highly our courses that are online are already scored. So it gives us a nice statistic to the book.
So that's all I have as far as my comments, but I'll answer any questions. I know we're trying to see if you would approve of this document, but are there questions? Yes.
It wasn't clear when I read in here about courses currently being offered at a distance or online, and with the budget review occur at that point when we go through the three-year review of the curriculum committee, or all currently offered online courses that haven't had a fee assessed going to have to do a budget?
I don't know about that. The idea on that was, I would say 99% of all online courses that are currently being offered do have a budget. It's only this year that we were allowed through our budget office and existing auxiliary policy to apply for individual courses, whereas a lot of courses, as some of you know, had to be lumped into, say, interdisciplinary accounts, etc. We now have permission, if you will, and all the way down from statute, new statute, new Board of Governors regulations, to allow us to create an auxiliary account for an individual course, a group of courses, electives, so it's not mandatory. As far as reassessing existing courses. If I understand your question correctly, every
This review process is done by the curriculum committee. Anything related to fees is done through ODL. That is not the curriculum review process of the 3 or 5 year review.
But I was concerned that a course had not been having a fee assessed.
Right, right, right.
What would trigger for that course, that department to be told that they're going to have a fee assessed?
The new campus solution system,
right,
will pick up all those courses because of the way the currently departments have course coders for the courses in CSN. Our office has course coders that go back and help with that process. Right now, we have so many legacy systems, there are a lot of errors. And the new form and the new systems should eliminate all those errors. We pick up courses occasionally that we see in the comment section, oh, by the way, this course is online, but there's no distance learning fee coded. And then we get a call from institutional research, the budget office, the IG, and the phone starts lighting up, and that's, we get told to go fix that.
Any other questions for Dr. Fiorito?
Yeah.
Susan, if I could ask a question about the academic integrity. On top of page 15, the phrase three lines down, high stakes exams, seems to indicate that the criteria for a course that need, an online course that needs to use the proctoring system, is that it contains something called high stakes exams. And I'd like to know what high stakes exams are.
Okay. Yeah, so would I.
The Center for Assessment and Testing and worked with, at one point, you had an ad hoc committee, you had an academic integrity committee.
Correct, through the faculty senate.
Was it mine? Yes. So I don't know the specific answer to your question. I know there was a percentage that that committee talked about what constitutes a high stakes test. I don't know what that number is. That language can be clarified or stricken, and I'm sure that committee, the members of that committee, know more about that.
I think John Mark was talking about 20%.
Was that the
20%
percentage?
20% and above.
If an exam was 20% of the grade,
then it represented what was considered a high stakes test. Now, SACS is very ambiguous on that, and so talking to my colleagues at other distance learning across the SUS, there are three definitions no one seems to be able to arrive at. That high stakes testing, distance learning, what is it, and hybrid. And those three things talk to very deeply to get some student answers. If it is a...
So we don't know.
I believe it's in that document, the ad hoc. Report from the ad hoc committee that was done 2 years ago.
We could certainly could we strike that? Could we revise that? I don't know who.
It's intentionally vague to give faculty the
if
they lock us into a number that then SACS or someone would come back and say.
I was on a curriculum committee at the college level last week. And somebody said that ODM is a 20% mark. The course, it was a brand new course being proposed, and it had a series of exams, each one of which was 15%. So it was below that 20% threshold. But it was going to be 3 or 4 of those, so the course grade was going to be at least half or two-thirds based on those tests. And they were all going to be administered through Black, which seemed to me to be an invitation to massive cheating. So high stakes on one test or high stakes on the whole component in the course is something that seems to me to be way up in the air.
And I know that committee, I know John Mark spent a lot of time actively, he's very passionate about this topic and very concerned about it. And I'm sure he'd be happy to revisit or clarify or take the advice of this body. I think it's up to that committee to.
Well, I think that should part of the job of the unit's curriculum committee or the college's curriculum committee is to say that as soon
Would you like more specifics in the document, Eric?
Not now.
Yep, he wants to go home eventually.
Well, and I think given our statement about faculty governance, that may be an issue that needs to be better decided at a local level than at the university level, so that is a very message.
Sandy, it's a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Sue, just a quick question on the three bullets that you show on the front page. When you talk about assessing these courses every 3 years, you're assessing based on the curriculum committee's requirements. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so if you have no changes over the three-year period, or you deem to delay changes until to manage the cycle, that's something that's up to the committee. How does that then relate to the third one, where you're talking about every 3 years, the appropriate committee, the faculty senate, to ensure they meet the requisite level of quality and provide comparable quality to the traditional type of experience?
Excuse me, but I can't speak to that. It's only because it's only referenced again because it was inserted in a different section for a different purpose, but it's the same. It will be the same review process.
Is that correct?
We have to make sure. Okay, so if we get an online course that's coming up for renewal, and notice that the objectives have changed and they're no longer measurable. Okay, they used to be, they aren't now. And again, we can compare them. Now in our paper documents, we can't. We just look and say, you know, these aren't measurable. The evaluation of students is not clear. We don't know how you're evaluating them. What percentage goes to exams or whatever it might be. Then we could send it back to that faculty and say, could you just clarify that? I mean, these need to be measurable, this needs to be, and then it would be a resubmission. We send courses back all the time for this, both face-to-face and online, if they don't meet that. So if nothing changes, if there is no changes, then it would be an easy check. There's no other quality. If it passes once, there's no other quality evaluation. Does that have to be matched?
No, I mean, you're talking about evaluating every 3 years now based on quality, which sounds different than what you're talking about.
Faculty need to resubmit it so we can look if there are any changes. And faculty can have the opportunity then every 3 years to make changes. They may have made changes all along. Do you know what I mean? In a syllabus, right? I mean, every semester a faculty member may make changes. So this is, in 3 years, send us your current syllabus. If it's way different than the one that was submitted previously, then we're going to look at it. If it's not, then I think that's what that means. Other questions?
Is there a motion to approve the distance learning policy and process?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Yep.
I'll keep it brief. As you know, the Graduate Policy Committee deals with GPC reviews, and that's what we're best known for. But we also address issues pertaining to graduate education on campus, and we coordinate and clarify policy language across a variety of different documents, including the faculty handbook and the graduate bulletin. We've been doing that more intensely the last year or so. Issues come to us for changes in policy language, tightening and clarification thereof, from a variety of sources, through our own scrutiny of these documents, and from faculty members and the graduate school. And what you have before you now are three such issues. I want to take up the longest one first, which in fact does not constitute a change of policy, but rather a clarification of language. This is the document concerning university-wide standards for teaching assistants at Florida State University. The changes that you can see indicated on this document by the underlining were necessitated by the necessity to be in compliance with SACS and to do with the contract requirements. So if you look at everything that's underlined, they're all little details. They're not actual policy changes, not substantive policy changes with regard to these standards. However, we feel that they are important, it needs to be accurate. And the idea is to incorporate this particular set of language in the, it'll be updated on the graduate school faculty and staff Blackboard site. Also on grad space, it'll be distributed in under the auspices of PI, and it could go into the graduate bulletin. There's a suitable place for this. It's the kind of thing that should have wide dissemination. It could go in the graduate bulletin around about page 77. So this one, I think, should be rather straightforward, but I will obviously take any questions you might have about it.
There's a motion on the floor from the standing committee. Is there any discussion about the university-wide standards for teaching assistants? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you. Now I'd like to take up the policy, the language that begins recommended change to existing policy. See Faculty Handbook, Section 5, Faculty Development. It's actually a change with respect, a very simple, straightforward change with respect to graduate teaching status. And as you can see here, the only highlighted changes have to do with extending the period under which these colleagues are authorized to have graduate teaching status from 1 year to 3 years. And the idea there is to, a reduction in paperwork, really, and to give greater flexibility to the units who maintain and hire these colleagues. So it's, you know, the idea is in fact a reduction in paperwork and work in general. The recommendation here, there's one change that has to be made, of course, which I guess I would regard as a friendly amendment, not yet amended, but not yet moved, but that of course has to do with changing the name of the dean of the faculty to vice president of faculty development advancement. That's another thing. The phrase, both of these, well, no, there's one change that came from the steering committee. The insertion of the phrase using criteria established by the Faculty Senate. And so this is the document that was approved by the Faculty Senate Steering Committee. Any questions about that? Yes, Jack.
We talked a
great deal about this, and it was there was a general consensus that you know that the special circumstances are going to be determined by the unit making this appointment, right? And we wanted to give those units greater flexibility and not have to be bombarded every year with another round of paperwork for appointments that would be extended up to 3 years. So that did not come up as a concern.
Any other questions? There's a motion to adopt the language on recommended changes to the existing policy regarding graduate faculty membership. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Last issue.
Thank you. This one has has to do with, essentially, it's inserting, coming up with language that was absent before. There was no official statement on conflict of interest, conflict of interest policy. And you can see here what that looks like, that this went through several rounds of revisions in the GPC and the steering committee. And this is what came back and was approved by both us and the steering committee. The idea is that it's to be inserted in the graduate bulletin in the section on graduate degree requirements in supervisory committee subsections for masters. So we go in on page 86 for the masters and also for the doctoral students on page 87. And then it should also be included in the faculty, in the appropriate place in the faculty handbook. And again, you can see from the date here that it's an issue that we discussed quite a bit in the GPC and in the steering committee. So.
Can I just clarify, the whole paragraph is new?
No, not the whole paragraph. Well, yeah, the whole paragraph is new. Yes, this is new. What you're seeing here, the additions, the changes made to the new policy that we brought, that we as the GPC approved back in February, and went through several rounds of revision. This is the final result.
Looked at this very carefully, so.
Good point, Larry. Thanks.
There's a motion to approve the conflict of interest policy. Oh, yes, sir.
Did you guys consider a faculty member might hire a graduate student to babysit for them?
We considered a lot of things. And believe me, this is probably one of the reasons why this was such a long discussion. And this could have been a much larger, much longer document because of that. We tried to come up with language that would, that wouldn't try to outline or prescribe every single imaginable situation. This is the one example we give here, is not all inclusive or exhaustive. And I think that would have to be, it would have to be considered. I mean, it would have to come up. Right? I mean, I guess everyone here could have graduate students babysitting for them now. I suppose. I think personally that would be a conflict of interest, and it wouldn't be up to me and my unit to make that determination. But if it came to the attention of our chair and the appropriate people in the department, that determination would have to be made. So I guess a more straightforward answer to your question is, I can't recall if that specific situation came up, but this language was meant to, be general and not list everything that might come up.
That answer your question,
Well, the implication is that this could create a conflict, therefore you have to take it to your chair or your department.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or you could hire a graduate student base for you.
Right, please. Yeah. I mean that the initial thought process has to, starts with us as individuals. If I hire a graduate student, it's my own graduate student, it might occur to me to ask, well, is that a conflict of interest? And it's and what we're trying to promote is that conversation, right? So that more minds look at the situation, and it might be determined that, no, that's not a conflict of interest at all. But that's the conversation that this language is designed to encourage.
Any other discussion or questions? But you have a motion to adopt the conflict of interest language before you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I don't know of any items of old business. I know we're running.
We are entertaining nominations for the Torch Awards. Marius Mortes Artes, rather than give you the definitions of those awards, you can look them up on the Academy Senate website. Please have them to us by October 1st, and you can send them to me at bRichard@film.fsu.edu. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Val. Other items of the university welcome, Dr. Durian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In view of the late hour, and that you've already had a report of collective bargaining from Professor Barrett, I'll keep this very short, but I'll be happy to take any questions. As you've heard earlier in the meeting today, budget developments and political environment have made for a difficult bargaining environment. Last year, President Barron spoke persuasively about creating a culture of merit. We tried to tell him that we had one in the Department of Merit procedures. He's skeptical. This year, the word merit raise, as of 2 o'clock today at the bargaining session I was attending before joining the Senate, merit raise seemed to be a dirty word. President Barron's remarks indicated that his bargaining team may need to meet with him and discuss this and get things clarified. So I remain hopeful about that. Given that raise, or at least cross-board raise, is a dirty word, we're talking more about things like restructuring the salary article. Hopefully that'll fly under the radar. We're also discussing academic freedom, performance evaluation, promotion, tenure, salary plan for professors, which may soon become a subject of a eulogy, benefits, and specialized faculty reclassification. There's a lot of issues on the table, a lot of fairly complex issues. For example, specialized faculty reclassification working document runs 44 pages at present. Lots of colors indicating lots of different contributions on different points of view. But that's my report. For I'll be happy to take any questions on that before I go on. Briefly. No questions? Okay, the only thing I want to make sure I mentioned to you was that we are featuring Vice President Sally McCrory at our luncheon next Wednesday, and I hope that all of you can attend. The luncheon is free for UFF members and their guests, $12 for others. You can make it 12:30. Florida room at the Oglesby Union next Wednesday, 26th. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any announcements by me?
I wouldn't dream of it.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you very much.
Very bad PR to talk at this time.
Yeah.
Thank you.